Hi, my name's Don Calloway. This is Wednesday, August 16th. We're in Healy Lake. We're in the house of Fred Kurtzetter, and his dad, Paul, is going to talk about his life history.
I was born and raised outside. Born in 1922, and I entered the service up here in Alaska. I entered the service. I came in during World War II. I came up here. I was stationed at 11th Air Force headquarters in Aleutian Islands. During the time I spent in the service here in Alaska, I spent most of it in the interior, flying around with a special crew, and I became equated with a number of native people during that time. We had the 10th Rescue, was made up of Eskimos, Indians, and prospectors, they did a lot of rescue work, downed aircraft and people in trouble all the way up to the Aleutian chain, all the way on the interior. And so during that time, I became acquainted with a number of Native people and had a lot of respect for them. They had, they were adapted to the country. They wore their own clothing, their mukluks and their fur clothing and whatever they wanted to wear, although they were in the service. And they did a lot of amazing feats in rescue work. Some of them parachute out of airplanes, dog teams, and then when an airplane would be located, and they would usually, if they couldn't snowshoe in or go in by dog team, they'd just jump out of an airplane and they'd see if any survivors. They'd paint a white cross on the airplane craft so it wouldn't be reported again. And I was discharged in 1945. I went outside and was discharged in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. I turned around, came right back to Alaska in spring of 46. I met my wife at that time, and that later became my wife. And we lived here in Healy Lake. At that time, in 1946, there were about five families living down here in the old village. And they had an epidemic here back in the mid-40s that almost wiped out all the families here. At one time, John Hajdukovich, the trader out of Delta, told me that there were 75 children here of school age at one time. And that when this during the World War II, it was hard to get doctors in here. The trader, Stanley Young, was a trader down there at that time. He told me he tried to get doctors in here, and there was entire families were dying and didn't lay in their cabins. This is my wife was here at that time. She's one of the survivors. Entire families lying dead in their cabins and then no one to bury them. And a few white traders and others was living down here by the trading post. John Knight, Fanny Young, and others was helping bury the people. And they finally got a doctor in by the next spring. He came up, an army doctor came out of what is now Fort Greene. He came in by Bert Hansen, brought him up. He was a resident. Bert Hansen was a resident of Big Delta. He brought him up by a dog team up here, the doctor. And the doctor, by that time, the epidemic was almost over. No tests were ever made, but by the symptoms and all, he thought it might be diphtheria and measles together. The Native people had very little resistance to whites' diseases. They had never been exposed to it like our race, and common measles would decimate an entire village sometimes. And then when they had these diseases, the elders was great for it. And if they felt a sickness, they would always get in a steam bath. And they have someone make a steam bath, and then all the men would get in their steam bath at one time. Well, it's a sick person in there. Like, they also had TB was rampart here too also, but that wasn't mainly what was the epidemic, whatever it was waterborne, I believe, because back in the 1930s they also had a epidemic here that decimated a lot of people here. And I believe it was from the water here on Hidu Lake. But most people I understand, were moving around. They're nomads. In the wintertime, the Hidu Lake people spent it most of their winter in the Joseph in the Middle Fork area over in the other drainage. They had their caribou drift fences up there. They had their caribou drift fences up Peter River. And they spent most of the winters up there. In the spring, they'd come back. It was a cycle. They'd come back here for the moose, the beaver, and the fish. They weren't dependent too much on fish, but although they did have fish trapped mostly, there's no salmon coming up this part of the town, I'll break you in this. So they depended mostly on whitefish. But they had traps down here on the Healy River, traps up the Healy River for whitefish. And then in the fall, they gathered berries and all. They went up in the Alaska Range over here for sheep and the marmot. And the women and all go along too, and they pick berries. And the women would snare the marmot, and the men would be hunting sheep. Then they would come back here and prepare to go back up in their up into their caribou drift fences up in the Upper Healy and Middle Fork, as far down the Middle Fork as Joseph Village. That was a Healy Lake people's area up there. The Army, Billy Mitchell, that was stationed at Fort Edward, to his journal, he came up, I believe, in 1901 up to from Eagle to Joseph Village in the winter to find a way through for the telegraph line going to Fairbanks. And he ran into the Healy Lake band at Joseph, the Chief Healy, and his band was up there at that time. He made agreement with them to lead him through the following winter to the Delta area, to find a route for the telegraph line, which was extended off of the Eagle line that ran from Valdez to Dawson and Eagle that way. And the following winter, he came up with his sergeant, and they contacted what was they called Chief Joseph. But Chief Joseph was really from the Salt Jacket. He was from here, but he'd married down the Salt Jacket. He came back up here. But he wasn't really the chief. Chief Healy was the chief, but he was the only one who could speak English, so Mitchell assumed that he was the chief. But he contracted with him to lead him. This is when it was 50 below, according to the Mitchell Journal. Led him up the Joseph Creek from Joseph Village over the head of the Good Pasture down to the village down at the mouth, close to the mouth of the Tanana, the Good Pasture River. Those people, there was pictures taken of the band up there, Chief Healy and his band, and it was been well documented and recorded by Billy Mitchell. He thought a lot of the people up there, but they had their caribou wickups with skin houses, according to the photographs they'd taken. And they told him they were Tananaw Indians. They came from over here. That was their place where they wintered up there. Sometimes they, I understand, they went into, joined up with the Ketchum stock group over there. They were related to the Ketchum stock people too, I understand too. And well, I'll get back to my wife and the Healy Lake people here at the lake. But I moved back here and in here in 1947 and stayed during the summertime. My wife and I, we moved in, and there were several other families here, but they just spent a little while and then they'd go move back out to the highway. And when the Alaska Highway was constructed, with Chief Healy, that was the chief of their, John Healy was chief of the band here, and he had moved his people, the survivors of that epidemic, he'd moved them up to Little Gersho on the Alaska Highway. So people, more or less, his people moved up there with him, the survivors of that epidemic they had, but they were still returned here all the time, and mostly in the summer, you know, fish and the moose, the beaver, and all. Anyway, my family, we lived in that old village, and Fred was born down there in that that old village. And but we carried, we hauled all our water there. The water was bad, you know, the lake water was bad. And we hauled our water from the creeks, the fresh water from the creeks in different places, because we were always afraid of that water due to past, you know, records of epidemics there. Then in about 1950, we moved over here to this location and built our cabin, dug the logs up, cut them by hand, drug them up with the dog team, built our cabin, and I raised our, we raised our family here. We had a garden, we had got our moose, we got our fish, we trapped for furs, and I did a lot of predator trapping and hunting for the bounties. And occasionally I'd go out and work in the summer at the Alaska Road Commission out of Tope. And but our family grew up here. We didn't, we weren't dependent on no outside money, BIA money or anything. We lived mostly strictly on subsistence off of the land here. The family, we had nets out here in the lake, and my family dried fish the year round. You know, not the year round, but all during the summer. We fished under the ice in the early fall. We had two big dog teams that we used for travel and for trapping and for bringing supplies in. We usually brought supplies in once a year and by boat. And but we lived right here off the country. We didn't live, you know, we didn't get any outside income other than sometimes when I go out and work for a month, maybe in the summertime. And anyway, finally, most of the people moved out of here for good, you know. They weren't even coming back anymore. So a number of years, and clear up until the 70s, most people were living out on the highway. Some of the band moved to Tanacross, Dot Lake, other places, some of the Fairbanks. And since then, there's a lot of descendants, you know, of the people who originally come here. There's quite a few. But very few of them that are still alive today, that the original people here that was here in 1946. And Chief Ely died, I believe, in 1946, up in the Little Gershel. And these people become pretty well scattered around. They went, the survivors there went on up to, like I explained, up to Dot Lake and Tanacross and Tolk, other places, other villages. But through the years here, we made a good living here. You know, it was pretty much subsistence. We didn't have much money to spend, but we lived right off the country mostly. You know, my family dried meat, moose meat, and caribou. When we could find caribou up Peter River, they were part of the 40-mile herd. They still are with the caribou coming through up there. They had traps up Peter River. The elders had traps up Peter River. I'd like to point out, I had the highest respect for the elder natives. Their knowledge of game and their respect for wildlife. And I never saw them waste game. When they butchered an animal, they took everything that was edible and what we would consider not edible. Even the moose in the velvet. They even chewed the horn. They took it over a fire and chewed that. Nearly all the organs of the animals they ate, the liver, the brains. Most of the brains were used for caribou and moose were used for skin tanning. But nearly all the organs they ate, the stomach and kidneys, all everything. And that they seemed to be healthy and they had good teeth. All the elders did when I came here. And they were very, you know, they were rustlers. They were always out, even the old ladies, the elders, they would out setting their rabbit snares and, you know, and dragging in their own wood. And surprising, some of the elders was way up there in age and they would cut and saw their own wood. Maybe the younger ones would help out. They would bring wood for them, you know, the ones that was too old, but a lot of them would be sawing their own wood. Carried into their cabins. They had a village here, down here on the point. At one time they had one across the lake, and they had one up Peter River at old Chief Healy's camp up the upper river. They had a village up there also, and that was more for caribou and fish from the upper Tanano. They had upper Healy River direction. Upper Healy River, they had by the old chief's cabin up there. They had, well, there was a number of cabins there, and they had tents. And there's also pits up there where they had covered, you know, with skins or bark. And they had all along the river still cache pits are in evidence, where they had to fish the white fish. They put in those pits, you know, and they put lined them with bark, put a layer of grass, layer of grass in, and then later they would cover them with logs and soil and moss, and later digging them up, and then they dried quite a bit of fish. They also put up caribou, you know, dried and frozen, and dried caribou also, moose. Everybody had, it seemed like everybody, no one went hungry that I knew of, and they weren't getting any handouts or anything like that either. So I had the highest respect, and I still do, for the elders, and I learned a lot about wildlife from the elders, and I still admire them, you know, they're in, how industrious they were, and how they could get along without nothing, and their survival here in the real harsh climate. On the trail, I've hunted with many of them and many of their hunting trips, and then hunted wolf dens with them and wolves. And they could call, like, you know, most wildlife, yeah, perfectly, and you know, and call moose, caribou, bear, muskrats, birds. This is the elders, you know, they were real, real good at it, and that probably contributed to their. A lot to their, you know, their knowledge of game and wildlife contributed a lot to their survival up here, because they talked about, the elders talked about famines, and they always put away, I understand they put away food for those kind of events. They had hidden caches out. A man and his partner, usually they would have a hidden cache way out somewhere. You find them all over the country here, on top of ridges where they were forked. That they made pits, and they put dry meat, clothing, weapons, and berries. A lot of times they put berries up in trees and make them. They pick berries while they're on a lookout, watching for game. They take a birch tree, knock it with rotten, and knock the inside out, and put sticks in the bottom and some moss, and fill it up with berries while they were watching for wild game. And they'd climb way up in the spruce tree and stash it up there. And they always talked about these caches, very important, you know, the way out. They'd be known just to the two partners, usually. They sometimes were married to sisters. But anyway, they had their own caches. And in the event that they got driven out by people coming through, they always talked about people coming through up here from down below the other side of Alaska Range, coming in here raiding their villages. And if they were driven out of their villages or their encampments in the winter, they always had clothing and weapons and food stashed someplace. And this was the reason, I understand, that they made those caches for survival. And then they talked about the Upper Tanana, where those people came over from Kwani Lake, that tribe, and shot a hole in them down there, and a lot of people that escaped, you know, that got away, and they did survive by some of the caches they way out, and later they went back and retaliated, I understand, but it was those caches that were driven out when it's severe weather, driven out of your encampment, not fully dressed, you know, and everything, with no weapons, it's almost a death sentence unless you have something to fall back on, the way they explained to old people, and which is understandable. But I don't know. What more I can say about the people here? They had a trader. The early trader here, I believe, was Newton. I came in here about 1917, roughly there. And first he was up in the Upper Tanana. We went up to Mansfield at that time, and traded some up there for one season. And he came back here to Eagle River and made a trading post down here. And he was here till about 1930, I believe. And his trading post burned down, and his family moved to Fairbanks for school, because there was no school here. And They started the school here one time, I understand, my wife told me, but it was only 1 year. Some minister, a man by the name of McIntosh, came in here and started school one spring, but that's the only school they had here. Heidukovich was a trader that went up with his boats all the way to Tetlin. Later, Herman Kessler, he ran his boats clear up to up around Tetlin and that area up there. And then there was other traders too. They was offhand, I can't think of all of them. But anyway, I've heard so much about them through my wife. You know, they had those steamboats and all came all, went all the way up to the Northway, I guess, to the Tetlin. Sometimes in the fall they didn't make it all the way up there, they could freeze in. Then the traders would have to unload all the material on the, to be frozen on the Tannenau someplace, and they'd have to unload everything and cash it. Later, after freeze up, fire the natives from the upper Tannenau come down with their dog teams and haul the trade goods upriver to their trading posts. Heidukovich had trading posts telling, I think, Northway and one at Tanner Cross. He also had caches along the river here at George Creek, Sam Creek, their little settlements there of Heidukovich people. And he had the trading post, had a little trading post here. But Newton was the main trader here for a number of years, and then it turned over to a man by the name of Emil Hammer. And Hammer ran the trading post for a number of years, and then he died on the trail, froze going down to Delta in one winter. And then the man Ted Lowell, Ted Lowell one time too ran boat up here and run and hauled freight up for Heidukovich, and I believe for himself too, traded. Ted Lowell took over the trading post here at Heady Lake. And Ted had the trading post, owned it during the World War II, and Stanley Young was running at that time during World War II. Stanley Young was the trader here at that time when they had the epidemic during World War II. And he was the one that told me that about him trying to get doctors in here to take care of people. But it seems, and I heard this from not only Stanley Young, but others in my life, it seems that some of the elders, before this epidemic, some of the elders, some of the people would get sick and they'd send them down with the traders' boats and they'd end up in Fairbanks or wherever. And then if that person died down there, and when they sent the body back, well then, of course, if they did an autopsy, well then the elders would look at the body because they dressed it. And here's, there'd been an autopsy performed on the body and they didn't understand. They thought the doctors killed him, because you know the way they conditioned the body, but it wasn't explained to them. So that was real hard to, some of the elders told me, to get any of them to send their, when they got sick here, to send anybody to Fairbanks. And their tradition was that they always bring the body back to the area where they were born, where they were from. And they talk about if a man was born here from Heady Lake and he married somebody downriver or upper Tannenau, he died up there, they always brought the body back, tried to bring the body back. Even in the wintertime, they couldn't pack it, they would, a crew go up there and bring it back with the sled or whatever. But they believe that's the spirit that had to be coming back to the locality where it was raised. And I think they still, especially the elders, follow that real closely. And it was real, I understand it was real hard feelings between the elders and the BIA when a lot of the people would go to Tannenau for medical help and die down there. And then they went to sanitariums for TB, and the bodies would never be come back. And so there was a lot of hard feelings between the elders and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and doctors in general, because they thought they were killing their people too. But it was understandable because they had no education, The upper Tannenau people were the last ones to be exposed to any amount of education, I believe. John Heidukovich and Jack Singleton was, I believe, the first teacher at a school up at Tetlin, and he was arranged by John Heidukovich. John Idukovich was instrumental in getting the Tetlin Reserve. He, John had about 30 horses. He was a U.S. commissioner for the upper town and all. He was a big game guide. He was on the Alaska Game Board, the Territorial Game Board. And during his time of guiding, he became acquainted with a lot of influential people like the Mellencoffs and others, Endicott, and a number of those people. He'd take along the Alaska Range here, he'd take these hunting parties all the way up to the upper Tanana, maybe spend 2 and 3 months at a time on hunting parties. At that time he hired mostly the Gila River people here, men to help guide, you know, because they were good. They were also good rivermen too. When John had run gas boats up for his trading posts upriver, he usually got John Healy or some of the Gila River Indians here to run the boats for him. And he hired a lot of them for his guiding party. And through the people that John had become acquainted with through these hunts, like Endicott and Mellencoffs and a number of those people, they had a good deal of political influence. John made a number of trips back to Washington, D.C., testifying about the natives in the upper Tanana, that the caribou were, back in the mid-30s was the last time any amount of caribou made the big migrations, I understand, through the upper Tanana. And John testified several times before Congress. It'd be a matter of record back here, I'm sure, that the upper Tanana people needed, you know, more game up here. So that's one reason the buffalo were set up here from Montana. But as it turned out, the native people never were allowed to use the buffalo, but they didn't seem to be much concerned about buffalo meat anyway. They were more concerned about their caribou and the moose. But nevertheless, that was the reason the buffalo were sent up here. But they were brought up, I understand, by the Tanana Valley Sportsman Group. They put the money up for transport them up here. And I believe the Park Service in Montana released that many for breeding purpose to send up here. So that's one reason why the buffalo come up in this area. And the upper Tanana people's area was from the Delta down here back to the Alaska Range, all the way up, and then the part of the good pasture, the Baltimore, and on the divide going up to the Mount Harper, and the drainage of the upper Middle Fork was their territory, and then back down over the drainage between the Mosquito Fork and across to the head of Benny Creek and across to the Robinson River. That was the area that the Gila River Band here claimed as their subsistence places. But getting back to the testimony John made in Washington, D.C., he told me that he got the reserve up there in the Tetlin Reserve. It was made by, I believe he told me, the executive order. It was never passed by Congress, although Congress approved it. But it was supposed to be, that reserve was supposed to be for all the natives from Delta on up to the border. Well, my wife tells me, and other elders, at times they used to leave here, would be during the spring, and when they hunt muskrats, there were a lot of people who leave here and they'd go up to the Tetlin area and the Northway area to hunt muskrats. But when there was no rats here, you know, rats run in cycles, and this area this year could be hardly any amount of muskrats, but up the river ways in different areas could be they could be plentiful. So they went up there, would go up there and hunt muskrats in the spring of the year. And they were, I understand, pretty much interrelated marriages between here and upper Tanana. And there's a number of families in Tanana Cross right now. At one time was here at Healy Lake, mainly the Isaacs and the Joseph families. They were originally from here, but moved up there later. Usually during those epidemics, you know, that people would move out. And anyway, is there anything else that you want to know that I know about? One of the reasons that I was, you know, successful as a trapper, you know, I came up in the lower 48, and of course I'd been a hunter down there and an outdoorsman under my younger days too, but it was a lot different here in Alaska, that's for sure. One of the reasons my success is through my wife, Margaret. She was born at Mansfield. Her mother was a Sam from here at Healy Lake, and her father was Isaac. Her father died when she was 2 years old, and her mother brought her and her sister back to Healy Lake. Then her mother married Patty Healy, and shortly after that, year two, Patty Healy died, and then her grandparents took her up at Sam Lake. It's another river up above George Lake, and raised her. And her grandparents never spoke English. They were a generation behind, and that they retained their old ways. They weren't influenced very little by whites. And Margaret, my wife, she always talks about it at night. Her grandparents her grandfather particularly would tell her about the old ways. Her grandmother taught her about the old ways, about everything from childbirth to things that were taboo in their culture, and about what wildlife, how the rituals they went through when they hunted wildlife and consumed it, and potlatches and everything like that. And so, being as her grandparents didn't speak English, Margaret never spoke English until she was in her teens, and then she moved back here to Healy Lake. But she never went to school, but she picked up the English language pretty quickly. And of course, when I met her, she spoke mostly native, but through the radio and conversing with me, she learned English and got real good at it. But she was an unusual woman. She was real proud of her race, real proud of her people. And when everyone left here, Chief Isaac appointed her chief here. She was chief here for about 25 years, up until 1970. And in fact, she was the one that fought for the land claims here. The Healy Lake was one of the unlisted villages. And we fought for 3 years. We had to gather up, you know, all the records and everything else and present them to the Department of the Interior to convince them that this was a village and was entitled to the settlement. And Margaret's name is on the claims. And my family was the only one that lived here year-round at that time. And had lived here for quite a few years. We were the only ones here. But others would come in, and they had their allotments here. They come in for their fish and meat, and quite often. Nevertheless, they most of them spent their time on the band spent their time out on the highway where there's schools. I self-taught with my children for 3 years, and then they went out to BIA schools because it was too much for me to, being as my wife couldn't read, so she couldn't teach correspondence, but I did for 3 years, and then I had to make a living trapping, so the children went out to Chamawa and Edgecombe and places like that. So Fred ended up with, he ended up going back east. He's a graduate of University of Vermont, but that was one drawback here was schools. But I think the schooling that they got by being raised here in a subsistence life, you know, style, was an education in it that others weren't fortunate enough to ever get. You know, they understand what we did here to make a living here and do what their mother knew taught them. And my success as a trapper and all, I learned mostly from not only my wife Margaret, but from the elders. And that's one reason I respect the elders so much, because after all, they survived here all this time, and with their knowledge of wildlife and how to survive here. And I've been fortunate, you know, to learn so much about their ways. And I have respect for all their ways. Their potlatches, system, their whole culture. Thank you. So I get it back to the Gila Lake people and their native people from there for signing off. There was accounts of, I've heard over and over from the elders and also from early prospectors, miners in the Chicken area up in the 40 mile. At one time there were a lot of prospectors up in the 40 mile, and it was a year that the steamboats got frozen in with supplies coming up in the Yukon, and so they were short of supplies of the miners and prospectors in the Chicken area. So the Ketchum stock people had fences for caribou over there, and they practically saved, you know, many of the miners over there by meat, you know, with the meat they were getting from the caribou, and they hunted for moose and all in there. One of the prospectors told me, he said they would try to pay them with gold, and they had no use for gold. They just threw it over their shoulder, you know, but you know, they had no way for payment, but they did it out of compassion for the prospectors, you know, the men that was in that area. And most of the early prospectors had a high respect for the native people. And the injured and the sick, and there's accounts of different prospectors and miners in the 40 mile area would become sick in the wintertime, severe weather, or injured. And the Ketchum stock people would put them on their sleds and their dog teams, with their dog teams, take them to Mansfield, which is in the Tananaw drainage. And then from Mansfield, the people there would put them on a sled and bring them down as far as Gila River here. And then the Gila River people would take them to Fairbanks. And they saved a lot of prospectors that way. And a lot of the prospectors, they really, really appreciated the native people, you know, in their ways. They were poor, they didn't have much, but whenever the people would enter their villages or encampments, they shared what they had. And most of them were honorable, their word was good. And John Adigovich told me that he used to leave caches of food all along the river up here for trappers. He would outfit them, and even though the native didn't speak English, well, he had access to those caches. He would take tobacco, rice, or anything that was, he left in his caches, and then in the spring, John would come up with his boat and trade for the fur, and he said he never got beat, but they'd always make a mark what they took, you know. John spoke the language too, which made it easier. And he said he never had anything stolen out of those caches. It was all through the years that he had up and down the Tananaw. But that's about all I can tell you about what I heard and understand about the upper Tananaw people and the 40 mile, the Ketchum stock people helping save lives of the early prospectors. Not only out hunting game for them, but you know, the sick and wounded, they would take them, haul them down to Fairbanks. You know, relay them from one village to the other.
If you'd like to speak to some of the hunting traditions or the cultural traditions.
Oh, there's lots of them. It took me a long time. There's about young girls grew up, you know, there was taboos or ichis, and about when they were ministrating, that, you know, they camped way out from the village until it was over, and a woman never stepped over a man's weapons, you know, when she was ministrating, and certain foods that the young people didn't eat, of the moose and the caribou, the beaver and other animals, certain young people were not supposed to eat them, women weren't supposed to eat bear. That's of this group here, although they vary. I've heard that some people up river, you know, just had a different custom. But here, the women didn't eat bear, and many things like that. And then they had certain customs about hunting. The caribou, they talk about, they always let the first of the bands go through, migrate through. They left their fences open and their corrals open. They had long drift fences, some up Gila River and up in the 40 mile, number of the Gila River people had up there, and then the upper middle fork, Joseph Creek. And the caribou migrating through, they always left, regardless how hungry they were for meat, they let the leaders of the caribou go through because they claimed that they left a scent trail or in the, you know, for the ones that followed. Once the leaders went through, that their belief was that then they could go ahead and corral the caribou. They had usually a circular fence, enclosure, and a long drift fence, and they been described to me. I've seen the outlines of those fences. I know where a number of them are in the country up here. You can still see the outlines of them where game through the years followed those drift fences and cut down long trails into where their enclosures were. The enclosures that were described to me as it's mostly circular, and the women and children would be way behind out in their route of the caribou approaching these drift fences, and then once they got past the women and children, they'd make rackets, you know, and drive the caribou down the drift fences into the encirclements. And it's described to me that the caribou went round and round. Well, the men in the early days, before they had white men's rifles, they had openings in the corral. They would set snares. The snares made out of sinew, braided sinew. And it set snares in those openings, and they could catch the caribou that they tried to escape. Then the men would run along and cut the tendons in the back leg, let the caribou, release the caribou, and put the snare back. And then they had an enclosure, you know, where they tell me they had bows and arrows and all that. So they could select the caribou that was the fattest. They knew which ones, the others were real sharp on game. They knew which animals at a certain time of the year which were the fattest. That's the ones they tried to take. And they, like I explained, they in the wintertime they froze a lot of the meat up on caches away from the dogs. And summer they dried a lot of their meat. When they traveled, they carried dried meat, berries, they stashed berries all over wherever they come back in the middle of winter. After the fall, they pick these berries and have them stashed. They could come back to these berries. There were certain taboos for potlatches, which way they stir the meat, the soup. The body might be taken out of window, brought in and out of the window in a community hall, or what we call a community hall. In a home, they sometimes if they had a wick up, I understand that the body was cremated with right there sometimes. There's places over at George Lake where they had the partly submerged pit, and usually two families lived in those places. They had the willows bent over in a dome shape with an opening for smoke to go out. They had both ends open. One side, and then they had a fire pit, a long fire pit, and they could drag logs in and burn them in the center. The smoke would go out the top, and then the heat from the fire would warm the ground on both sides of the shell. And they were partly sunken. And then the one family lived over here, and the other was usually, this is where your partnership came in, and the families stayed together, you know. So one family on this side, one family on the other side. Those are still evident in some places around here, those pits. And house bits, I understand some time of death there that they might
It's Healy Lake, August 16th, and we're talking with Fred Kerstetter.
Hi, my name is Fred Kerstetter. I was born and raised in Healy Lake. I was the my name is Fred Kerstetter. I was born in Healy Lake. I was the last one that was born at the old village site at Healy Lake. I was born in 1953, and pretty much I was raised out in the Healy Lake setting with just the family and a subsistence lifestyle where there would be just my parents and my intermediate family, my sisters, and we lived under the umbrella of basically a subsistence lifestyle, and a more rewarding, probably more economical way of life. Really, I think it was more of value living. And as far as the enrichment from my mother, I think we were pretty much enriched with her traditional ways and some of the customs that she passed down to us. Sure, had benefited us in our discipline and our daily life on up to our adulthood. I would like to say that after spending 3-4 years in my education with my father, with correspondence, I was sent to Chihuahua, and I spent 2 years there. And we were approached by Dr. Robert McKinnon. He was the anthropologist for the Upper Tanana area at the time of 1966-67, I believe. And he introduced me to a program, Native Studies program, called ABC at Dartmouth College. And the coordination became possible by my findings of artifacts of my and some of the heritage of my people. I was collecting arrowheads and other implements, spearheads and implements such as stone and obsidian arrowheads. But I think the findings led itself to my educational ways that perhaps gifted me into getting a college degree from the University of Vermont after attending summer school at Dartmouth. I kind of left the East Coast and came home in 78 after graduation. My father followed my mother's tradition of being the assistant chief, you might say, because I became a chief through her custom that led to the development of a village here at Healy Lake under the Land Claims Act that passed in 1971. We implemented the progression of that with benefits of getting our land, our people, and restoration of just basic social and economic goods. But for 20 years I served in that capacity, and up to this point I pretty much was in the political realm because I graduated with a degree in political science. I felt that it was adequate, that it would serve me in the system that we worked in and with the Native people and the issues that confronted everyone in the interior and statewide. In that regard, I was pretty instrumental into securing the schooling and the basic setting of Healy Lake, and the people that reside here are part of my benefits that I work and strive for. And I believe that with our younger people getting more and more educated to the awareness of the traditional sense of our people and the values that our ancestors may carry in its heritage, I believe that those things that that are taught to them by the elders that are so limited now in their numbers, I believe that it does carry some value on them to pursue their education, whether it's social or educational in the academic field. I feel that this is really necessary, that Native children from Healy Lake or other places that go through the acculturation or assimilation fine line, maybe, that if you will, that they would learn that their basic home rule is that you pursue the best you can. It's just our way of making survival modes the way of life in every way we can. Getting back to my point of my home, my mother had taught me some traditional ways of being aware of not only the respect of the animals, but the traditional usage of eating habits and the traditional ways of learning the hunting ways of our people. I think one of the first things that I wore were bones from beaver to make me work hard. For example, I had a necklace that had some hawk claws to make me swift and be more witful when I make delivery of what I have to kind of grasp when I was later learning in life. And another thing, I remember going through initiation of having to eat porcupine hearts so that I won't get scared out in the woods, so that it would teach me not, when I grew older, that it would come back to me that fear would not be my way of my behavior when I got older. I think that all these values and these things that my mother used to put forth on me, and I think they proved rewarding. I stepped out into the real world back east, and it was hard for me because coming from a small setting like one family in rural Alaska, a trapping home, and making it into the real world, you have to have more than just basic educational calibers that qualify you to get through life. I think that it takes a lot of self-determination. I believe that family values, like again I said, my dad and my mother, Paul and Margaret, have raised my family to the utmost of well-being and wholesome. I think it has a lot to do with going out and striving and working for everyone. I think it's a unity effort when you start to look back and how the Healy Lake Band and its people and Chief Healy had taught their people to be more communal and to start with the family values and the things that kept the web in tune to structure your life. I think families and the people should work that way. And that's pretty much what taught me to survive, really. I think we're looking at a changing world today, as you seen the elders and they stressed the education as one of the things we all need. I think we're looking at a generation here where we're not turning back, not necessarily, but we're looking at subsistence as something we take for granted. But it seems to each day we're looking at trying to grasp onto some of the traditions and some of the inherited things that are necessarily really a great deal of strength and a fibering of our culture and our survival ways. I think hunting and fishing is part of that, and it's going to continue to be part of all of our social gatherings, including the potlatch and beyond just setting food on a table for your family. I don't know what to say, but getting back to my educational experience, I find it very difficult. I would highly recommend it to other Native students that want to pursue their education, but I must remind you that my educational purposes were more than just educational. I think the social aspects of life kind of intertwines with your academics. I believe that meeting people and making friends and relating to them with their interests certainly has its weight on your accomplishments, on getting your work and your accomplishments in order. When I experienced going to school at Dartmouth, which was a Native Americans program, I felt a sense of pride where there were other natives from North America that were attending the school. It was a program called ABC, A Better Chance. I was there with other upward bound or native prospects that were potentially going to college, and I was one of them that was fortunate enough. I was recommended by Dr. Robert McKinnon because I had some qualities in pursuing my education. I believe that the challenge was sometime pretty tough. It was like banging my head against the wall, you might say, but I find that after a year or two of being away from home and being alone and trying to pursue my academics in the world of being in the Ivy League, it was the hardest part. But I believe that if you have a healthy mind and was willing to meet other people to relate your problems and then to share their interests, whether it's sports or some of the things that we find interested in, and to share with others, I think that's the bottom line of surviving in the academic world. If one chooses to pursue the educational needs of being an Alaska Native in a rural area, whether it's a village or a small place like Healy Lake, I had some fond memories, and I don't think I ever had a bad memory of learning and being able to achieve what was put forth as far as my degree was required, my prerequisites, and it was just a matter of getting down and putting some discipline into your hard work and studying. But I found that later in life it paid off. I was injured, however, being in a wheelchair, but I still maintain that my mind is healthy enough to purposely go on. I raised two children. They're now going to, one going to boarding school, one's getting trained in this fall in Delta for mining school. I find that coming home and accomplishing the educational needs, I related that to my children, and I raised my two children alone and with a tight family, and the the things that I were taught were fair and stable, and therefore I raised two children that were healthy in mind and body. I feel that it was rewarding when you can go out alone and find that you can better achieve, make achievements in your own way of setting your own goal by just basic hard work. After coming home, finishing school and being a parent, I feel that my accomplishments and some of the things that I've looked through and what I've contributed to my home, my family, and my village, what services I provided with others, what I shared, what I gave, and what I took, as far as, you know, some misunderstandings sometimes, but I feel fairly well with what my accomplishments are. I try to digest that I did the best I could. I think that everyone should come to a conclusive thinking that you're not always perfect, but I feel happy for what my accomplishments are. I believe that I contribute a lot to my community and made perhaps regional impact on my people. I worked for the Tanana Chiefs as director of wildlife and parks. I was in that capacity of service for 4 years. I found that the challenges were there, and I found that there was not any more that I could do to serve, so I came home after that to serve my corporation. I worked on the board as president and as chief in its capacity with the council. And I worked for the e-board, and I worked on, also after being injured, I became paralyzed, but I found my capacity not limited. I was appointed by the governor to serve on the Vocational Rehabilitation Commission, which I have, and that was from 85 to 90, I believe, and I served that to the best I could. In fact, some of the things I incorporated within the state acknowledgement with the vocational rehabilitation regulations were that hunting a vocational setting for people like myself to go hunting and fishing whenever we can. And so subsistence is not an issue for me. And I feel very comfortable to say and still display some gratitude in my accomplishments. I might be a little selfish with it, but I'm still happy about that.
Okay.